from Zillion Interactive Center. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Okay, this is Alternative Visions, and today we're going to have two parts to the show. The first part, I want to talk about Biden's capitulation on the infrastructure bill yesterday, what has happened and what all that means going forward. And then I want to continue discussing Keynes's economics as opposed to Keynesian economics. We started that last week, and some important additional understanding about Keynes that mainstream economics has rejected pretty much. That rejection gives you Keynesian economics, which is not Keynes. So we're going to have the second part of the show. We're going to continue our educational or whatever you want to call it here on understanding what Keynes actually said, not what the economics establishment, conservative business and academics who've never read Keynes say he said, and they teach all the kids in college this nonsense, which is not Keynesian, but they call it that. Okay, we will get to that in the second, continue that in the second half of the show, because it is related to policies, economic policies. It's Keynesian economics that give us neoliberal economic policies. Neoliberalism is all designed to maximize and shift incomes to the wealthy and their corporations at the expense of wage earners and the rest of us. Okay, so we'll get to that in the second half. Let's talk about the first half here. What's happened with the capitulation, and that's the only way to describe it, of Biden to McConnell and the Republicans on the infrastructure bill. It was announced with a lot of fanfare and photo ops. Biden agrees with this so-called bipartisan group of 10 Republican senators and 10 Democrat, the moderates, the conservatives, the blue dogs, whatever, to $579 billion for infrastructure spending. This is essentially the Republican position from the beginning. The only concession the Republicans have made on that total amount is that in the beginning, they proposed to pay for that by diverting $350 billion from the previously passed COVID relief bill, the American Rescue Plan in February. Remember that? $1.2 trillion, actually, spending. They say 1.9, but it's 1.2. That's all. They've agreed to $579 billion, the Republicans, McConnell and friends, now of new spending. New. In other words, before it was $200 billion, plus they were diverting $350 billion. So they were just moving money around. And then they were playing games saying, oh, our position is $950 billion. Well, they were taking $394 billion from already previously authorized spending on transport and other areas in the budget. And that's how they got originally, they Republicans, to their $950 billion, moving $394 and $350 and the rest, about $200 billion of actual new spending on infrastructure. Well, now they've dropped the moving the money around, and they're saying, okay, $579 billion in new infrastructure spending, traditional infrastructure, you know, water, electric grid, roads, bridges, stuff like that, okay? So that was their concession, but their number always stayed the same, roughly, you know, in the $500 billion to $600 billion range. That was their total number, just how you pay for it. And also, of course, they've held firm, they, the Republicans, McConnell, have held firm, you know, that is not going to be paid for by raising taxes. In other words, reversing some of their friend Trump tax cuts in 2017, cut taxes, $4 trillion, $4 trillion, folks, not what the media has been saying. They leave out the $2 trillion that U.S. multinational corporations got out of the whole deal. So it was $4 trillion, and they've been protecting that. They had to get the number down low into the $500 billion range in order to argue that no, there's no need to raise taxes on our rich friends to pay for it because it's low enough. We can pay for it by raising the gas tax and raising fees, i.e. on consumers and households, right? And then funding it through bonds, government borrowing, a traditional way. So that's what we got here. Behind this, the charade of these negotiations is the Trump tax cuts. And to get the number low enough so now there's no argument that we need to raise taxes on the wealthy in order to pay for it. And, you know, Biden already cut the taxes on corporations, right? Unilaterally, by the way. He dropped it. So that got that out of the way. So the only thing left is the personal income tax, you know, taxes on those who are making $400,000 a year in income, the alternative minimum tax, inheritance tax. You know, there's other measures that Biden proposed during his campaign, and now he's just stripping out step by step. He stripped out the corporate income tax that was to be raised to 28% from Trump's 21%. It was at 35%. And leaving, of course, the loopholes still there. But now earlier last month, he dropped that. He dropped that corporate income tax hike from 21% to 28% and therefore dropped $850 billion of potential income from just that corporate tax hike, which is only half of what Trump had cut in the first place, you know, 21 to 28, it was 35. That would have generated $850 billion more to help pay for infrastructure. Well, when that was gone, the financing for, you know, a $2.3 trillion infrastructure bill here, you know, the pressure was off. But now, you know, at $579 billion, the pressure is off to pay for that $579 billion. And I expect and predict we're going to see Biden drop his tax hike proposals on the wealthy individuals and their investors. So behind it lures all this way of dismantling the proposed tax hikes, you see. That's behind all of these bills. People should keep that in mind. And this is the real face of bipartisanship, you know. I mean, they had a photo op here yesterday. With the Republicans, 10 Republicans and the Democrats and Biden. And I understand a photo op, you know, Republicans smiling so broadly, they almost busted their face. Yeah, this is their bill. This is their bill. This is what bipartisan means, their bill. And you got to understand the politics of this, too. You know, old Manchin, Joe Manchin, Democrat blue dog from West Virginia, sort of throwing a wrench in the the negotiations by saying he wouldn't support anything that wasn't bipartisan, right? Bipartisan. Well, Manchin is the point man taking the heat here, you know? I believe that the corporate wing of the Democratic Party always wanted something about this dimension. They did not want a big bill because they don't want the tax hikes to occur either. And it's the corporate wing that controls the Democratic Party. And Biden is the corporate wing representative candidate, right? But to take the heat off Biden, they had Manchin. Manchin taking the heat as the point man. We won't agree to anything that's not bipartisan. Well, of course, Biden said the same thing. But Manchin takes the heat, you see, because if they don't have Manchin's vote, they can't do budget reconciliation, you know? There's 50 Republicans, 50 Democrats. They could do it. They could have passed whatever he wanted, whatever Biden wanted. They could have passed the $2.3 trillion, you know, except that they would have to have 50 Democratic senators, including the blue dogs, Kristen Sinema from Arizona and Manchin from West Virginia. But they were siding with McConnell and the Republicans, and secretly, I believe, the Democratic corporate wing here, and said, oh, no, we won't agree to the 50-50 that you needed for budget reconciliation. In other words, to pass it with 50 votes plus one, which would have been, the vice president sitting over the Senate, Kamala Harris, she could have broken the tie. They could have passed this, 2.3. They could have passed everything, right? Just as they passed the COVID relief bill that way. They could have passed this. Bipartisanship was the key word here, that excuse that they used, right? Both Manchin and Biden and the corporate wing of the Democratic Party to say, oh, we can't do this without bipartisanship. And that, of course, eliminated the possibility of budget reconciliation here. That's the politics behind this. Don't think that this is just inept in negotiations by Biden. You know, this is the dance. This is the policy dance. This is the legislative dance for public consumption. They could have passed this. They didn't. They used bipartisanship. And now we got this stripped down $579 billion proposal instead of 2.3. If you go back to the original, proposal of Biden for infrastructure, 2.3 trillion, right? That was composed of four segments, four parts. The first part was traditional infrastructure spending, roads and bridges and water and so on and so forth, right? The second section of this was a $400 billion subsidy to tech and corporations and manufacturing. $400 billion. That was part of the infrastructure bill. And then the third section was about the same amount for child care and elderly care and climate change. Was the fourth section about the same. Okay? Those sections, child care, elderly care, and other human infrastructure have been stripped out. So has just about all of the climate change. That's been stripped out. So half of it is really been eliminated. And what you got here in the $579 billion is traditional infrastructure plus the $400 billion subsidy, and that's what it is, to corporations, particularly multinational corporations, manufacturing, and tech. Now, all along in recent weeks, both sides, Democrats and Republicans in the Senate, have been stripping out and passing or about to pass legislation as part of that $400 billion. There was this separate deal that has passed the Senate. I don't know if it's passed the House, to provide a $52 billion subsidy to tech and manufacturing companies to provide chips, semiconductors, chips, right? $52 billion, a subsidy. The government's going to give them. Intel is going to get, and their friends are going to get $52 billion. The auto companies, who were lobbying Congress and threatening shutting down some factories, auto factories, saying, oh, we got a chip shortage. We got a semiconductor chip shortage, so we're laying people off. In other words, they started going on strike here, capitalist strike, in order to push this through Congress quickly. They didn't know the outcome of the infrastructure bill yet, to ensure that they would get this subsidy, $52 billion. Oh, we have a shortage of semiconductor chips. Well, why? Because you moved it to Taiwan. You moved the chip production, the general, not custom, but general, mass production, chip production to Taiwan and Asia. That's what you guys did. That's why there's a shortage, because the supply chains have broken down. So they've used this. They created the problem. They've used this as an excuse to lobby Congress. Oh, we want our $52 billion to be insured and quickly. And of course, Congress passed it. Well, that $52 billion is part of the $400 billion section of the American infrastructure. Oh, both sides were all in agreement with that. They hustled and pushed that through. And the auto company said, oh, we have a chip shortage, you know. And all of a sudden, when it got passed through, oh, production came right back. Oh, what kind of shortage was that, right? It was all lobbying. Auto companies and chip companies lobbied Congress in recent weeks to get their $52 billion. Plus, they got an increase. They got an increase in the investment tax credit to 25%. They got a big tax cut on top of it. So who knows? You know, maybe it's $100 billion eventually here. Big subsidy. Big subsidies to manufacturing companies. Another $110 billion was in this other bill that is working its way through Congress called the New Frontier Act, right? New Frontier Act, $110 billion. That's an R&D, research and development subsidy for tech and manufacturing companies. In other words, the government is going to give them $110 billion. There may be more. I've been able to identify $110 billion out of it. R&D subsidies for manufacturing companies, right? Now, what that is really, and the whole $400 billion of this section of the American Jobs Act is really a way of subsidizing American companies and manufacturing companies in competition with China. This is about tech. This is about next generation manufacturing products based on new technologies, because the U.S. is being beaten by China in global trade on technology and new product lines coming out of new technologies. Trump tried to deal with the Chinese with a stick. He tried to levy tariffs and use tariffs as a bludgeon to get the Chinese to back off of a new technology and development. They didn't. He lost that fight. Biden and the Democrats are really subsidizing U.S. corporations. In other words, giving a carrot to U.S. corporations to compete. Trump was trying to beat down China and the other side to increase the competitive balance here in favor of the American corporations. Failed. Now the strategy is to subsidize $400 billion here in various forms, chips, you know, New Frontier Act, whatever. In other words, give a carrot. In other words, the government will give them money to compete. Yeah. Oh, you know, is that infrastructure? No. Oh, are the Republicans complaining that that's not infrastructure? No. They're complaining that, you know, developing childcare and elderly care and climate change, you know, they're saying, oh, that's not infrastructure. That shouldn't be in the bill. You know, infrastructure is roads and bridges and so forth, right? That's infrastructure. Well, yeah, that's traditional infrastructure. Oh, but manufacturing tech subsidies, oh, they have a problem with that, even if that's not infrastructure as well, you see. Yeah, it's where the money flows, you see. Anyway, the second section here is this $400 billion subsidy to manufacturing. And I'll bet you that's the lion's share of the $579 billion, plus some traditional infrastructure. But I bet the subsidies are even greater than the traditional infrastructure. I haven't seen the breakdown yet, but I'm willing to bet that. And, we'll report on what is the composition of that $579 billion. And we'll also report on, as it is revealed more clearly, how are they paying for it? Is it tax hikes? I doubt it. Is it going to be gas tax increases and other fees on the consumers and households? I'll bet you. Huh? Oh, that's where you're going to get it. And it's going to be borrowing. The Fed is, you know, issue bonds here and let the banks get a taste out of all this financing here. But, you know, $579 billion is the real face of bipartisanship. You know, no tax hikes. Is the real face of bipartisanship. Subsidies for manufacturing tech companies is the real face of bipartisanship. And don't think that this wasn't planned and engineered this way from the very beginning. You know, I can just imagine Manchin and the corporate wing of the Democratic Party and Biden, you know, quietly getting together with the bankers and so forth and saying, we got to go through the negotiation charade here before we can do this. And that's what's happening here, right? And, you know, Pelosi comes out with this feeble spin on it that, we are not going to agree with this unless we have an agreement that we will do budget reconciliation for what has been cut out. Ugh. That's just a spin of the moment to soften the blow, right? There's not going to be any budget reconciliation on elderly care and child care and climate. That's DOA, dead on arrival. You're not going to see any more fiscal subsidy, which raises a question. Is $579 billion sufficient to provide stimulus to the economy going forward? You know, the COVID relief bill, a.k.a. American Rescue Plan, that was a bill that was designed to quickly throw money at households and the economy here in order to keep us from falling back into a recession. You know, that's what that was. A quick throw some money at the black hole that was emerging bigger and bigger at the end of last year. Because if you look at 2020, what was happening? We had a 10.5% collapse of GDP in the first half. We had a reopening of the economy, tentative, at the end of the second quarter, beginning in the third quarter of last year, where the economy recouped 7.4% of the 10.5%. And by the way, it's 10.5% on $2 trillion, and it's 7.4% on $1.8 trillion, you see. So it really wasn't 7.4%. But, you know, it did bounce back. It did rebound in the third quarter last year. But that rebound dissipated, fell apart in the fourth quarter. And we barely had the economy growing at 1% GDP in the fourth quarter. And it was going further south starting the first quarter of this year if something wasn't done. Because the CARES Act that was passed earlier in the year, which was not 7 trillion dollars, as I've argued before, actual spending was about 1.3 trillion. That dissipated, there was no follow-on stimulus. The Democrat tried to pass the HEROES Act, they couldn't get it past McConnell, right? And at the end of the year, unemployment was rising fast again, and people were about to lose their unemployment benefits. So they had to throw, you know, another $800 billion to continue the stimulus. And that bought a couple months, but that dissipated as well by February, March. That's why the American Rescue Plan, the COVID-19 relief plan, had to be thrown in to provide another temporary mitigation to the economy, keep it from collapsing again in the first quarter, which it helped do. But they needed a real stimulus once again in 2021, to follow it. The $2.3 trillion infrastructure bill was supposed to be that. You know, as the economy again rebounded, opened up once again a second time this spring. So we kind of got a deja vu here going. You know, the CARES Act was insufficient, temporary stimulus. Right? We had an opening of the economy that collapsed. The economy sank back down. Now we had another stimulus in early 2021. The economy reopens again, rebounding, right? And we're getting this feeble $579 billion. Because remember, it's not all this year. It's spread out over, I don't know, 5 or 8 years. And if it's infrastructure spending, it's not going to be spent right away. You're going to get no stimulus effect. No stimulus effect from traditional infrastructure and subsidies from U.S. global manufacturers. You're not going to get any stimulus this year. So once again, the economy is opening up and we don't have a follow-on fiscal stimulus bill. The child care and elderly care and some of the subsidies for households, you know, in the climate change, alternative energy, we're supposed to give a follow-on stimulus as the COVID relief bill, American Rescue Plan, dissipated over the summer and the economy opened up. So we got a deja vu. We got a repeat going on. We got a rebound opening up with no real follow-on fiscal stimulus now, just as we did last year. CARES Act, opening up rebound, no follow-on fiscal stimulus, economy sank back. We will see whether that's going to happen again by the fourth quarter of this year, whether this pattern continues. Republicans always bet that, all we need is to reopen the economy and everything's going to be right back where it was. You know? No. The economy has been fundamentally bludgeoned here by this whole event of the last 18 months. And there are fundamental changes occurring in the labor markets, in the product markets, in the capital markets that I believe mean there will not be a sustained recovery simply by reopening the economy. We will get a boost here in the second quarter, and we will get a boost in the third quarter as the reopening continues. But will this be enough to get a sustained recovery in the fourth quarter and not just another temporary rebound? You know, a rebound is temporary. Relapse can follow a rebound if there's no real sustained spending to keep the economy going into a sustained recovery. I think that's the big risk here. We'll see what happens the fourth quarter. Now, a big change is you got the vaccine, right? And the vaccine means people can go back to work. That might be sufficient. But in certain parts of the U.S., geography and economy, people aren't refusing to get, they're refusing to get vaccinated, right? And now we got this variant D and the D plus variant coming, you know? I suspect certain parts of this country are going to have another bad wave of COVID come this winter. Right? Whether that will be sufficient to cause the economy to kind of shut down in places, it won't happen where you have a high vaccination rate. Remains to be seen. But there's that risk. There's that risk. We'll have another relapse here. Anyway, what we got is the spin going on that the $579 billion is going to create jobs. Well, we shall see. But it's not going to create them very quick, right? And the labor market has been bloodied, and people aren't going back to work the way, you know, everyone predicted they would go back to work. In fact, you know, we've got unemployment claims, new claims, still at around 500,000 a week here. The latest claims, over 400,000 still for the traditional unemployment program. And then, of course, over half of the states, red states in particular, have discontinued unemployment benefits for freelancers and self-employed and so forth. They've discontinued that. That was the supplemental federal PUA unemployment benefits. So we don't know how many people are unemployed and who are in that category and can't file for unemployment benefits now because it doesn't exist in 20, 30 states. Right? So the number is at least 500,000 a week going on of claims. People newly unemployed, I mean, that's as bad as it was during the worst months of the Great Recession in 2009-10, 500,000 a week. Yeah. So that's where we are. The labor market has been fundamentally harmed. Product markets, the same thing. Product markets, we have this big problem with the supply chain being busted in many places and other product problems as well. And then in the capital markets, in other words, financing, investments and so forth, again, we got this trend of the money being provided by the Fed, $120 billion a month, continuing free money to banks and businesses and speculators. Yeah, they don't have a problem spending that. That money going largely into financial asset markets, stocks and bonds, derivatives and so forth, right? That's a problem, right? But they're not doing anything about that, you see. They don't want to do anything about that. Oh, and they're, you know, arguing about how much cutting of fiscal spending to households, but they keep pumping $120 billion every month into the banks. Yeah, for as long as, there's... The Federal Reserve Central Bank is saying, we're going to continue this at least through 2022. So, you know, we got 18 more months of that. $120 billion going into investors, banks and investors, right? And they're dickering around shutting down any stimulus real folks, wage earners, right? And by the way, you know, cutting the unemployment benefits, which is occurring now, and cutting people off of rental assistance, which is going to occur after one more month, you know, that's going to impact consumption and housing. You know, that's going to impact consumption, no doubt. As, you know, the COVID relief stimulus dissipates, you're going to have more unemployment, more people evicted. And we're talking about millions here. And that will slow down the economy by the fourth quarter as well. Okay, so let's just keep in mind that this is deja vu, 2009-10 in many ways. Biden is following, you know, the same trajectory here strategically of Obama here, a minimal stimulus here. At the same time, we've got austerity emerging, its ugly head, in the form of cutting unemployment benefits, in the form of cutting rental assistance, right? Deja vu. The capitalists think that just reopening the economy is going to be enough for a sustained recovery. I don't believe so. We're going to get a rebound here, right? But we'll see by the end of this year whether the rebound is a recovery. And because they're different, it's not the same thing. You need a continuum massive fiscal stimulus, not a temporary, a partial stimulus that's quickly withdrawn prematurely, right? That's what gave us years of near stagnation and flat growth under Obama. And at the same time, of course, the rest of us have flat growth, but the Fed keeps pumping free money into banks and investors, and they do quite well, you see, and cut taxes on the rich. They do quite well. But the rest of us struggle with this trickle down. All right, which leads us to the second half of the show. I want to continue talking about Keynes' economics, right? And how it's not Keynesian. Keynesian economics is really a bastardized version of cherry-picked arguments in Keynes, wedded to pre-Keynes and the economic ideas that Keynes himself attacked. You see, that's Keynesian economics. It's a synthesis of pre-Keynes and safe Keynes. In other words, those things in Keynes that the capitalist and the established economic discipline, very conservative, don't want to talk about. You know, just to recap the points I made last week, and then I want to go on to some new points in Keynes' economics. Okay. To recap, we talked about three things last week. We talked about Keynes's concluding chapter of his book, The General Theory, written in 1935-36. Right? The concluding chapter pointed out that capitalist economies have two great Achilles heels. One is they always tend towards income inequality. Right? It's natural. It's endemic. Right, it's inherent in capitalist economies to create inequality, income and wealth inequality. He pointed that out. He concluded with that. Well, that's pretty radical. He also concluded with the argument that unemployment was endemic. In other words, capitalism could not really resolve the employment issue, the employment problem, right? Didn't want to in many cases because it likes all that excess unemployment, keeps wages down, you see, makes unions more difficult to represent their membership, you know, when you have massive unemployment. So unemployment and income inequality were two basic trends of capitalism, and he brought that out in the last chapter after he did all his analysis, which is really a critique of capitalist investment, really. That's what the book is really about. But you don't hear that in College Econ 101, macroeconomics or intro macro courses. No, you don't get Keynes. And you, to the extent that anything comes from Keynes in Keynesian economics, it certainly doesn't mention that trend towards income and wealth inequality and greater unemployment. And yes, it is greater unemployment. You know, when you look at all the people in the advanced economies who are totally unemployed, plus those who are partially unemployed, part-time temp work, right? They should be covered, plus all the people who drop out of the labor force, who are effectively unemployed, but not counted in the official figures as unemployed. When you really look at that total number, you know, unemployed, partially temporary, unemployed, dropouts, you know, labor force participation, dropout rate, employment to population ratio, when you look at it in long-term, chronic unemployed, when you look at that, not just the full-time workers who are unemployed, which is the number they give you in the media, right? When you look at that and then you look globally as well, because capitalism now is a global system, unlike any time before, when you look at it that way, yes, unemployment is rising. You know, hours of work, unemployment is rising in the U.S. and elsewhere, and it's going to rise some more because we have artificial intelligence hitting the economy now and increasing, and that's going to throw out, you know, according to McKinsey consultants, up to 30% of occupations are going to be devastated by AI this decade. Create more unemployment, you know, more part-time unemployment, more total unemployment, more dropout unemployment, right? So it's true. Keynes was right in raising those red flags that, you know, capitalism has these two great Achilles heels. But his major argument was against trickle-down economics, you see. Keynes started out his book, just to recap what I said last week, he started out his book by criticizing the economists before him, using as a straw man this number one economist in the world, Cecil Pigou. And Pigou represented the prevailing thought about why there is a depression and how you get out of it. And Pigou's argument was, oh, to get out of a depression, what you need to do is increase the disposable income for businesses. Increase it. How? Oh, by lowering wages, by lowering interest rates, by lowering taxation. Sound familiar? Yeah. That would put more money in the hands of investors, of businesses, right? Which it was assumed by pre-Keynesian what was called neoclassical economics, that businesses would spend that increased disposable income. They would invest it, you know, in time zero immediately. That would hire more workers. That would increase more wages. That would then drive consumption, which when now you have this virtuous cycle of consumption raising investment and raising consumption and wages and so forth. Well, Keynes correctly said that this was nonsense. That it wasn't business investment that created employment. It was employment that created investment. In other words, it was not give disposable income to business and that would generate wages. No, it was wages, increasing wages, that stimulated demand for products and therefore stimulated business investment. In other words, the causal relation was asked backwards, according to pre-Keynesian economists. And, you know, they still maintain that, don't they? That's what trickle-down is. Trickle-down economics is let's give businesses money so that they can hire people. Let's cut their taxes. And by the way, we cut $15 trillion of the taxes since 2001, and that will generate investment in the U.S. and jobs. Well, the problem is it hasn't generated investment in the U.S. A lot of it went offshore, multinational corporations, because capitalism is global, right? A lot of it went into financial asset markets instead of into real investment that created jobs. We cut $15 trillion in taxes, and we got a molehill, a mountain of tax cuts and a molehill of job creation. And a lot of that job creation was low-pay jobs here. You know, we lost millions of jobs to free trade and offshoring investment and U.S. corporations moving around the world. Yeah, and of course, now when you get a pandemic, you've got a problem with supply chains because, you know, all the PPE equipment is made out in Asia, right? And you can't get it. You can't get inhalators. You can't get masks and so on and so forth, see, because it's all moved off. A lot of the drugs are moved offshore, created and manufactured offshore. So this trickle-down economics was asked backwards, according to Keynes, you know, and Pigou would argue, well, give businesses more, cut wages. That's how to get out of depression, cut wages. And Keynes says, no, that's the problem. Wages are cut. There's no demand to buy products. And if households and workers aren't buying products, then businesses won't invest. You can give businesses tax cuts. You can reduce their interest rates. You can give them wage cuts, and they'll hoard it. They'll just sit on it because there's no one to buy their products because no one else can afford it. You see, that's what trickle-down economics really is. Well, that was pre-Keynes. But, you know, the economics establishment and discipline still argues that nonsense today, a lot of it, right? Oh, we got to give business tax cuts to create jobs. All the $15 trillion of business tax cuts since 2001 have been called Jobs Act, Jobs Acts, right? And is it infrastructure? The American Jobs Act is still doing that phony spin, that cutting, giving money to businesses is a Jobs Act. There's no evidence of that causal relationship. Okay, so this is what we kind of talked about last week. You know, income inequality, unemployment, business disposable income as a way of trickle-down and generating recovery. Well, that's not Keynes. That's contrary to what Keynes argued. What did he argue? Well, he said, look, you know, the problem with neoclassical pre-Keynes is that they see that investment and consumption are the same thing, and there's one cause, right? Stimulate investment, that stimulates consumption. And he says, no. There are independent causal factors driving consumption and independent factors driving investment. The second part of his book identifies these independent causal factors driving consumption. And basically, it is the change in income. The level in change in income for households is the main determinant for whether you can increase consumption or not, right? Now, wages and jobs is a big way of raising income of households. But other ways raise income of households too, like, unions can help do that. Of course, now they're destroyed. They barely exist except in the public sector and some services that can't be offshored, like longshore, right, or hospitals or something. Okay, so it was raising income for households independently of business investment that was the key for stimulating the economy and getting a recovery. Right? Now, that's anathema to those who believe in trickle-down economics. That's bubble-up economics, right? Give it to households, and households will increase their spending on products. That will be a signal to business that, oh, let's increase production, therefore let's increase investment and spending. And you get a virtual cycle driven from the consumption household side, not a negative cycle driven from business investment as a way of getting out of the recession. Okay, and then he developed a new concept called the multiplier effect, how the multiplier for households in stimulating consumption and the economy and GDP is greater than the multiplier for tax cuts for businesses or for investment. Yeah, and the multiplier was a major tool that sort of advocated that you got to give it put more money in a crisis in the hands of those who will spend it all and not hoard it, right? Put it in their hands, and that's a better way of stimulating recovery than putting it in the hands of those who will hoard it or divert it offshore or put it into financial markets. A major argument, right? Consumption, on the consumption side. But then most of Keynes's book is an indictment of capitalist investment. That's mostly what it is, you see, and the role of money and interest rates in that whole process. One of the axioms of pre-Keynes economics, and still today taught in textbooks for college kids, is that, savings, increased savings will stimulate investment. Or lowering interest rates will stimulate investment. So it's savings increases and lowering interest rates, which are the variables that drive an increase in investment and therefore the economy. This is just another version of trickle-down, a little more sophisticated argument of why you should give money to businesses. Right? Well, how so? Well, the idea is the amount of savings out there represents the supply of money. And if it is a big supply of money, businesses will invest it, right? They won't want to hold on to a supply and have it not make money. They will, commit it to real investment. Or the corollary argument is lower interest rates, and that will stimulate investment too. Keynes didn't believe in either of those. Yeah, listen to that. Keynes did not argue savings determines investment. And of course, the savers were the wealthy people, see? And he did not believe that lowering interest rates stimulated investment. He believed the causal relationship was just the opposite, right? That it was investment that stimulated savings, and it was investment that drove interest rates. In other words, the causal relationship was reversed, just as in trickle-down. Trickle-down, Cecil Bagot argued, the way to increase wages was to lower wages, right? And that lowering wages would stimulate employment and their rise, and therefore a wage rise. So it was cutting wages drove investment. Well, it's the same argument. Cutting interest costs drive investment, right? Cutting business taxes drive investment. Just a variant on the Pigou absurdity and the misunderstanding of the causal relationship of what drives investment. Keynes reverses that. He says, no, it's investment that drives savings. In other words, the more investment, the more profits that are made from production, and therefore the more savings that investors would have. And even households would have, increase investment, increase production, increase, you hire people and you have more wage income, and households save, and businesses save by increasing their profits, right? So savings is a consequence of an increased investment, not a cause. And we have the same argument, really, with regard to cutting interest rates. Cutting interest rates don't stimulate investment. It's investment that drives interest rates. When investment is booming, right, banks can raise their interest rates higher. When investment is collapsing, right, banks have to lower their interest rates. So what is the causal direction of these variables? Interest rates, right, wages, investment, savings, and so forth. This is pretty radical. But, if you go to the economic discipline, and even liberals like Paul Krugman, they argue, let's lower interest rates. You got to keep interest rates low if you want to stimulate investment, right? For most of the economy, there's no evidence of that. Most of the economy. Look, these multinational corporations don't give a damn what the interest rates are in the U.S., they can go borrow money anywhere around the world if they even wanted to borrow it, right? They don't invest by borrowing money very much. Only 20% of investment portfolio investment is driven by internal profits. Most of it is driven by raising debt. Corporate bonds, corporate commercial paper, and so forth, right? And they can go anywhere in the world and get the money cheaper if they wanted to borrow it, but they don't borrow it. They got massive hoards or they go into the stock market that's booming and they issue more stock, right? Or they issue corporate bonds to raise cash, right? So, you know, it's not interest rates that stimulate investment. Yeah, there's some sections of the economy that this may be true, you know, maybe in housing and some, you know, other areas that aren't subject to global economics, right? You can't move these things offshore. Maybe the public sector, right? But mostly, you know, interest rates have very little to do with stimulating investment. And we see this time and time again, where in the Great Recession and today and previous times, they lower interest rates virtually to zero and investment does not occur. It does not occur, right? Or they cut taxes and we don't see investment and job creation occurring. You know, but Paul Krugman and all these other mainstream economists, even liberal economists, who are Keynesian, not Keynes, right, perpetuate these fictions. And they call it Keynes's economics. It's not Keynes's economics. What drove investment, according to Keynes, was business expectations of profit in the future. It wasn't interest rates now. It wasn't tax cuts now. It was profitability expectations, you know, a very psychological thing, uncertain thing of what profits would be in the future. That's what drove investment, or what he called the marginal efficiency of capital, right? Profitability. And it wasn't interest rates, and it wasn't the cost of the investment. It was expectations of profit. Well, you know, Keynesian economics does not deal with expectations theory at all. No. Expectations and business confidence is totally left out of the picture. And that's mainstream economics, you know. Why all these things, mainstream economics? Because it's all designed to justify subsidizing businesses and investors. Yeah. Oh, cut interest rates. Oh, cut wages. Oh, increase their savings with tax cuts. Right? Oh, boost them first and trickle down the rest later. You see, economic theory, Keynesian economic theory, is a justification for all of these policies, economic real policies in Congress and the central bank and so forth, which enrich investors and the wealthiest 1%, you know, and their corporations. The corporations are institutions that are conduits to distribute wealth, income and wealth to their shareholders. That's all they are. They're vehicles and conduits to do that. And they do that quite well, just in the form of annually stock buybacks and dividend payouts, over $1 trillion a year just in the last 10 years, every year of stock buybacks and dividend payouts. Over $1 trillion. Now, when the system crashes a little bit, you know, and it looks like, whoa, the average folks are going to be really hurt and they're going to be angry, well, they'll throw a few crumbs at us. They did, you know, CARES Act, COVID relief, right? They'll throw something at us. But when it's over, when it's over, they'll try to take it back. And that's exactly what austerity is about. And that's exactly what Obama did, you know, $787 billion stimulus bill, $300 billion of which was tax cuts, you know, in 2009. And in 2011, he took back and cut spending by $1.5 trillion. Took back twice of what he gave, agreed to give, you know. And then, of course, he extended the Bush tax cuts for 2 years at a cost of $800 billion more. And then he extended it in 2013 in perpetuity for $5 trillion more. Obama cut taxes more than George Bush did. That's a fact in 8 years. Well, Trump comes along and he cuts it as much as as Obama did, but in 4 years, you see. So they're ratcheting up this tax cuts for businesses. But it's all about subsidizing business incomes. And the argument is this traditional Keynesian argument, pre-Keynes, Pigou neoclassical argument that if you subsidize businesses, increase their disposable income by tax cuts or wage cuts or whatever, interest rate cuts, that they will reinvest that quickly, you know, not hoard it, and that will create new hiring, new employment, new wages, new income to buy the products. But it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen that way. You give it to businesses in a crisis, they're going to hoard most of it. What you got to do is give it to those who will spend it all, who have a higher multiplier effect. And that's households. And the poorer the household in terms of annual income, the more of it they will spend. They will spend all of it. And you'll have a greater a multiplier effect and a greater real stimulus to the economy. Well, look what we've done. Look what we've done. Well, we threw some money into households last year and this year, but then we cut it off pretty quick, and we don't have a follow-on investment to keep the economy going to a sustained recovery. And what we get is what we got now. You know, to go back to the argument, we got an opening in the economy. We got a rebound going. Maybe it's better because you got vaccines now, right? But don't discount the problem with COVID totally here. And we'll see what happens in the fourth quarter. We'll see what happens, because if you don't continue the sustained income support for households and wage earners, then it dissipates and it fades after 3 to 6 months. And that's what happened last year. That's what may happen again this year, because the stimulus bill on infrastructure is insufficient and not timely. The composition is insufficient, and it's not going to happen this year, probably next. So all we got here by the end of this summer, the COVID relief bill is going to fade out. Yeah, you got opening in the economy. Will it create a sustained recovery on top of the rebound that's going on? It didn't last year. It may this year. But we shall see. We shall see. But I really believe that we've seen all we're really going to see in fiscal stimulus here. And the Democrats, Biden, the corporate wing, you know, you got this anomaly of the progressive wing that keep railing about, let's do Keynes's economics. But the corporate wing says, no, let's do Keynesian economics. So this theory is really practical and real in the real world here going on right now. And that's the truth about Keynes's economics. And I haven't really talked about, I'll finish next week on Keynes's economics, talking about his views on fiscal speculation, financial speculation, and how that poses increasingly a danger to capitalist economies.